I am Paul Harris. Ian and Dan are here with me, and now Colin Jeffrey sheds his cape that he wears while doing his role as news director here at the Big 550 and puts on the tights and other cape that he wears while being his superhero alter ego, Showbiz Boy. Hi, Colin. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
I'm doing well. How are you,
Paul? Doing just fine. Thank you. What time is Ian coming to work today?
I don't know. I was here an hour earlier than I should have been, apparently.
Oh, you're exhausted? That's your excuse?
Yes.
Wiped out by the overtime? All right. We have a bunch of movies and other showbiz stuff to do. That's what we get to in this hour on Friday afternoons each week. And this week we have three movies to review for you. I have two. Colin has one. And since I have more, I'm going to start, okay?
Fair enough.
The first movie today is The Intern. I guess it's the biggest release of the weekend. This is a Nancy Meyers movie. Nancy Meyers is the woman who has made a lot of movies about middle-aged people. She did It's Complicated with Meryl Streep and Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin a couple of years ago. She did Something's Gotta Give with Diane Keaton and Jack Nicholson a few years before that. She did that Helen Hunt, Mel Gibson movie, What Women Want, in which Helen Hunt looked unbelievably good, by the way. So she's made all of those movies, and now she's made The Intern, which stars Anne Hathaway as the CEO of a tech startup that sells clothes online. And it's been an amazing hit and has grown from 25 employees to 200 employees in something like 18 months.
I love Anne Hathaway.
Well, then you'll like this movie, because she's in the movie a lot, as is her co-star, Robert De Niro, who plays a bored retiree who doesn't have much to do in his life except go to his friends' funerals, and he's traveled a whole bunch of places since he retired, but now he's home and doesn't have much to do, and then he sees a flyer for a senior citizen internship at this company. And he goes and checks it out, and he gets hired to be Anne Hathaway's intern slash assistant. And he, in taking on that role, becomes a mentor to her and to some of the young employees. But he becomes a mentor to her kind of against her wishes at first. Of course, they're not going to have a romantic attraction here because she's 32 and he's 70 in the movie.
Okay.
But, and I'm glad they didn't do the May-December romance here. Or I guess in that case it would be February-December. I'm glad they didn't do that. The romantic interest is provided by Rene Russo, who is, I'm going to say 60, 62.
Yeah, I bet she's right around 60.
Something like that. So only 8 or 10 years younger than De Niro's character in the movie. She plays a massage therapist who works at this company and goes around giving employees massages, or I guess they come to her massage place at the warehouse where this whole company is set up, and gives them massages. Anyway, she and De Niro... thank you. They make the romantic couple in this movie. And meanwhile, there are the questions of Anne Hathaway's character and whether she can handle not only running this whole big company by herself, but also she has a husband and a kid. And it's the classic, can women have it all kind of question. Well, apparently they can if they have Robert De Niro helping out as a guy who was in business for 40 years and knows a lot. And once she allows him to share some of his expertise with her, things start going better in her life in many, many ways. Oh, and by the way, when he has to drive her to and from work and picks her up at her Brooklyn brownstone every morning, there's the guy she's married to, who's now a house husband, taking care of their kid. And of course, Robert De Niro is better at dealing with the kid than the house husband is. Because he's the perfect guy in this movie. There's nothing that he can't do and does it all in this movie. Here are the problems with The Intern. Anne Hathaway's character is a successful CEO, wife, and mom who does not know how to delegate anything to these 200 employees. And so she micromanages everything. And that is an annoyance, and I'm sure it will be to some women who will go see this. I think this movie will succeed certainly more with women than for men, although I could also see it as kind of a middle-aged date night movie for couples that want to go out on a Friday or Saturday night and see a movie, or when it comes around on Netflix, I'm sure it'll get a lot of rentals there. But the movie is 20 minutes too long because of something that I'm not going to give away, but there's an extra plot point that is shown, that is thrown in here at about the hour and a half, hour 35 mark, that is completely unnecessary, completely extraneous to everything else that's happening in the movie. It does not need to be in there, and it makes the movie 20 minutes longer than it should be. So, is it a horrible movie? No. Is it a great movie? Certainly not. 6 out of 10 for me, for The Intern.
Okay.
Now, is that something you would go see?
My wife loves these movies.
Yeah. These Nancy Meyers movies.
She doesn't know the director's name. She loves the other movies she's done, though.
Yeah.
So.
They're very, very decent chick flicks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Holiday.
I guess she makes the high-quality chick flicks.
She does. She makes the most palatable, and I think what my wife and a lot of other people who like her movies like, is the conflict in those movies is about 5 minutes long. There's not like this big, oh, is it all going to work out?
Yeah.
It's quickly resolved conflict.
Yeah.
And I think that's nice to be able to turn your, just sort of not worry about what you're watching.
And I will say this, in a Hollywood that makes movies for younger demographics 95% of the time, this woman, Nancy Meyers, is about the only one who I know makes movies particularly about middle-aged and older people.
Yes. It's a horribly underserved demographic,
yeah.
So it'll do well.
Yeah, but you were shaking your head no when I said this will be the biggest movie to open this weekend of the movies that are opening. What will beat it?
The one I went to see.
Of course.
Of course.
It's a competition.
Wait,
for college.
Tell me it was Hotel Transylvania 2.
That's it.
Sweet. I want to see this one, too.
Did you see the first one, Dan?
Yes.
You liked it?
I liked it a lot.
Obviously, since you want to see the second one.
Yeah.
Should he go?
If you like the first one, I think you'll actually like this one more.
Okay.
The previous Hotel Transylvania set the record for a September box office open. So this is in a typically underserved month. So
I don't even remember this first one.
No, I never heard of it before.
It's about a hotel. It's an animated movie.
Adam Sandler.
I didn't know it was animated. Yes.
Adam Sandler's in the movie?
No wonder I never heard of it. He's Dracula, yeah.
Oh, it's an animated movie?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
That's why it's not on my radar.
No, it's really good. I took my daughter to see it. Well, when did it come out?
2012. 2012.
Okay. So,
3 years ago.
Yeah.
So she was 15, and we went and saw it and loved it. And she wants to see the second one here. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
tell us about it.
The second one is out. If you have not seen the first one, you may want to go back and watch it. But the idea is Dracula runs a hotel in Transylvania that was previously monsters only. Now it is not monsters only. Humans are allowed because of what happens in the first one. His daughter is now married to a human who invaded the hotel. The same human from before. They keep everyone around. So Adam Sandler voices Dracula. Selena Gomez, Mavis, his daughter. Andy Samberg plays Jonathan, Mavis's now husband. Well, Mavis and Jonathan have had a little baby that is now human. And the crux of the story that kids will get in this is he vampire too, or mm-hmm. is he just entirely human?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what kids will get, this little baby, Dennis, which is just a really funny name for a kid. I don't know. Dennis is like a baby in an animated movie. Just kind of made me chuckle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, of all the things, what an odd name to give
what
a
were you expecting?
Baby.
Dracula 2? Dracula Jr.?
I was expecting something cute, like Joey. I mean, an animated kid name, and then they're like, oh, Dennis. It just...
Okay.
I don't know. Just really odd.
Fine.
The movie, this is the largest issue I'm going to share with you. Pixar makes films for adults and kids where the adults get something on a level that the kids don't generally pick up on. If we look at Inside Out, the kids aren't going to pick up as much on sort of parents worrying about how their kids adjust and what that does to parents and not understanding what's going through their kids' minds all the time. The kids are going to pick up on, you know, joy and sadness, trying to sort through the memories.
Mm-hmm.
Pixar does that really well. This is not a good example of it.
It's not a Pixar movie.
No. But I will say, there's a place for movies like this that are just fun, that don't have to be movies, animated movies that you're going to take your kid to and you're going to have to bring a pack of Kleenex because you're going to cry. You're not going to cry at this. It's just a fun animated movie.
You're telling me that a movie that Adam Sandler is in has no subtlety or second level of story? I find that hard to believe,
Colin.
Wait
a minute.
I will say he wrote this with Robert Smigel, who's now his writing partner.
Triumph the insult dog.
Who I really, and if you go back and watch You Don't Mess with the Zohan, which was about the ninja hairdresser who used to be Israeli Mossad.
Okay.
It's a ridiculous premise, but it's the most lively Adam Sandler movie in quite some time. It feels different, and that's because Smigel came
You over. Have to get out of the house more often.
Did he write the first one with this guy too?
Yeah. Oh yeah, these guys wrote this, and so it's very frenetic. It's fast-paced. The first one was real heavy on sight gags. But what I'm saying is this movie has an issue where helicopter parenting and trying to sort of force yourself on your kids, overly parenty. When I say that, you all conjure an image. That is in there almost too much. Like it gets uncomfortable, and I think kids are going to pick up on that, and it's just really odd. It almost feels like Sandler and Smigel were sitting there and like, kids are too coddled these days, and they write something where that's sort of the point, and it overwhelmed the rest of the movie. All of that aside, it's much funnier than the first one, I think. The first one was very heavy on sight gags. It had minutes at a time where there was nothing being said. You were just on a ridiculous ride and things were happening. That's fun, but it's not good for adults. It just doesn't play well. This has more jokes in it. But the other big issue I have with it, Mel Brooks plays Adam Sandler's father in the movie. He comes in at the very end and is like horribly underutilized. How can you not use Mel Brooks? He doesn't have to physically walk around and act, so age isn't an issue. And they bring him in. They try and shoehorn him in at the very end, and it was foolish. They get out. It sounds like I'm being really critical of this. I'm not. It played much better than the first one. And I think that's what frustrated me the most is the first one I wasn't a huge fan of. I thought it was fun. But this, I felt like, was going to be a better movie, and at times it really is, but it just has these few things that hold it back. All of that, it's still funny. You're going to laugh. There are going to be things parents get that the kids don't. It has all of those necessary pieces for an animated movie now, but it's just, you're going to feel like it's lacking something because they tried to do something better and almost hit it.
Almost.
Almost.
Okay, so on a scale of 10?
It gets a 6 out of 10.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, it's good for kids. It's not too scary. It's much more slapsticky than the first
one. And we should adjust this for the Dan rating. 10 out of 10 for you, Dan.
10 out of 10.
Oh, great. Thanks. 10.
And our third movie for this week is called Stonewall. Do you know what Stonewall is?
That is, I can't remember where it was, but it was the site of sort of the gay rights revolution, let's say.
I thought it was a wall made of stone.
It is the name of a bar in New York City, in Greenwich Village, that was the place where a riot took place in 1969 that was a seminal moment in gay rights history. But if you go see the movie Stonewall, you will find out that the seminal moment in gay rights history was actually the coming of age story of a boy from Indiana who was misunderstood and moved to New York. That's what this movie is. This is going to be on my top 10 worst movies of the year list.
Wow.
It is absolutely horrible. The Stonewall is the place where in 1969 a group of marginalized and persecuted gay men and drag queens and transgender people and a whole bunch of really angry bar patrons fought back against a whole bunch of corrupt police officers who had been harassing them so brutally. And they sparked the riots that would begin the whole gay rights movement. The first gay rights marches came after that, and of course the recent decision on gay marriage in this country. But this movie isn't really about that. It's about Danny, an Indiana farm boy, who is caught committing an oral act on another high school boy who happens to be the quarterback of the team. Danny's on the football team, and this guy is the quarterback of the team, and the quarterback doesn't want to endanger his future, so he tells everybody that Danny had gotten him drunk and forced him to do this. Danny's father happens to be the football coach, who, of course, wants to keep the quarterback, and is not really happy that his son is doing gay things, And so the father ostracizes him, and then word gets around the school about what Danny did to Joe, and everybody at school ostracizes him. So naturally, Danny picks up and goes from Indiana to New York, because, you know, in 1969, it was easy for a high school kid in Indiana to have the money to pick up and leave the state and go to another time zone.
Mm-hmm. Well, which part of Indiana were they in?
Yeah.
That's true. That's a good point. Hundreds of miles away, I should say. So he goes to New York, and naturally, on his first day, carrying his little, perfect little suitcase, he meets up with a bunch of male and transgender prostitutes who take him in and befriend him, and he becomes enveloped in their culture. And some of them actually do go on to fight back against the injustices that are done being done to them. Others of them are just thug-like thieves who steal stuff because they want it and don't care about anybody else. And, you know, there are drugs involved, although not as much in this movie as there probably were in real life. And the problem is that the director of this, Roland Emmerich, who is known for such historically correct movies as The Day After Tomorrow and Independence Day, he just gets this story completely wrong. Here's how wrong he gets it. The movie ends with title cards on the screen. You know the kind of thing, you go to a movie and at the end it tells you what happens to the characters after it, whether it's based on a real story or it's a fictional thing. And then so-and-so grew up to be whatever it was. Well, in this one, you get title cards that tell you about what happened to some of the characters in the movie who did in real life go on to be central to the gay movement, and we're leaders of the gay movement. The problem is, in the movie, none of those people are central to the story that we see on the screen. So we don't really know their story, and thus we don't really know the story of what happened in the beginnings of that civil rights movement in New York in 1969. All we find out about is how a poor farm boy from Indiana fit in or didn't fit in with the gay men who were prostitutes and the transgender prostitutes who were on Christopher Street in Greenwich Village in New York. And it is horrible. When I go to press screenings of movies, I have never walked out of one. Well, that's not true. I walked out of one years ago, and it was a press screening I actually hosted as a station promotion. It was The End of the Affair with Liam Neeson and Julianne Moore. It was so bad that halfway through, I walked out. And the next morning, I got calls from listeners. You know, we saw you walk out, and we were waiting for our cue because we had to get out of there, too. It was so horrible. That movie was horrible. This one, I wish I had walked out of as well. It's called Stonewall. I don't care if you're straight, gay, transgender, or any of the letters that make up LGBTQ exclamation point, hashtag, whatever you identify with, you are not going to like this movie because it is not just historically inaccurate, it is a bad movie.
Okay.
And that's what offends me more than anything else. 1 out of 10.
Whoa.
For Stonewall.
1 out of 10.
Yeah. Bad, bad, bad. Worse than The Gambler.
Oh, wow. That's pretty bad.
Maybe tied with the Woody Allen movie.
Which one is that again?
I forgot the name of it already. An Irrational Man.
Oh, there we go.
Which is probably going to be my worst movie of the year. We're not even through September.
And you already have 2 or 3 of your worst movies of the year.
Yeah, maybe more. Speaking of movies, next week on the show, we'll be talking about Mississippi Grind, which is the movie I've been mentioning on this show for 20 months now because I'm in it. I'm on screen for about 2.5 minutes of this movie.
You're the star.
I'm not the star.
Co-star.
I'm a glorified extra. That's all.
But Sienna Miller was actually cut from Black Mass, by the way.
I didn't know that she was in that Whitey
Bulger
movie. She
was supposed to be the girlfriend. They were going to show initially some of the time when Whitey Bulger was on the run.
Yeah.
And she was supposed to be his girlfriend.
So did she actually film it, and then they cut her scenes out?
She actually filmed it, yeah, and they cut her scenes out. Catherine Gregg, Caroline Gregg, something like that. That's a person's name.
Yeah.
Hey, so when they do that, and they cut her out completely like that, do they have to pay her?
No, it's volunteer work. I don't know.
No, you absolutely get paid. You absolutely get paid.
If you're completely cut out.
You know, the most famous one of those in history was Kevin Costner in The Big Chill.
Really?
Kevin, if you remember, The Big Chill starts with a funeral.
Yeah.
A funeral of, I think, a guy named Alex. Mm-hmm.
Sounds right.
Alex was played by Kevin Costner. Not just, they didn't just hire him to be the corpse in the casket. There were flashback scenes showing all the people in The Big Chill with Kevin Costner. And then when the director of the movie looked at it, he realized, wait a second, I got a movie that's way too long here by 30 or 45 minutes. I have to cut out all of the flashback scenes, which means I have to cut out all of Kevin Costner, and any shots of him in the casket or anything that happened previously have to be out. And so he got paid, but he's out of the movie.
Wow.
I bet that happens more often than not.
Sorry, I distracted us there.
Oh, I was just going to say that next week I will have the writer and director of Mississippi Grind on the show with me to talk about the movie and give it a little extra boost because it opens in St. Louis next week.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we going? We should go and have a red carpet. Even if it's just us, we should just get a little red carpet.
All right.
And put it somewhere at some movie theater where we go and just have you walk on.
I'll tell you what I'll do. Next Friday on the show, I will announce where the movie is playing and a screening that I'm going to go to. And if you guys want to go and any listeners want to go, not like I can arrange a free entrance for you.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to pay for everybody's ticket, but if you want to go to that screening, we can all go and see the movie, and then afterwards you can tell me how bad I was.
Cool.
So that'll be on...
I think there's going to be a big autograph session at the end. That's what I think.
Well, if you want to sign autographs, Dan, that's up to you. That'll be next week. Other showbiz stuff we have to touch on today? You told me in the hallway today you had something about Netflix.
Yeah, so Netflix tracks everything we do on there. They know what shows we're watching, how many of them we're watching, if we go back and rewatch that. They have all the metrics. It's actual true ratings. They don't release all of them to us, but what they're trying to defend is there are people who say Netflix releases shows all wrong. All the episodes at once is foolish because if you don't get on board, it can get spoiled for you real easily. And they argue, TV stations and TV executives argue, this is a bad format.
That it's better to do it week by week.
Yes.
Because that way people can watch it and have the water cooler discussion. But I think that that's wrong because you take TV shows that two people do binge watch, you know, Breaking Bad, one of the famous examples, or other shows of recent history, Sons of Anarchy or whatever it is, that people don't necessarily watch all
week
of
to week
until they get it later and they do binge watch it. Or even if it is on every week, let's say there's a show that's on Monday night. You may not watch that until the following weekend because you recorded it and you don't have time to watch it during the week.
Exactly.
With time shifting, we don't have the, except for sports, you know, a Cardinals game or the NFL, who watches live TV anymore so that we all have that simultaneous global experience? Nobody.
It's not done as often. No. And a lot of stuff is DVR'd.
Okay.
I mean, a lot.
So what's wrong with the way Netflix does it?
We're going to come back to Breaking Bad here. So Netflix just sort of says, we're going to do things our own way. Well, now they're starting to leak out some data. And leak out's probably... They're releasing some data they've been collecting. They looked at 25 of the most popular shows on Netflix. And what they determined is how many people watched each episode and when do they get hooked. And the way that they defined hooked is after this episode. So let's say 100 people watch episode one. At what point through the rest of the run of that series does the show maintain at least 70% of that original run forever? So if they get 100 viewers the first one, then they get 75, then they get 70, and they get 70 from there on out, the second episode is where they're hooked.
Mm-hmm.
But if they dip below, they have to look to see, is a show, do people get hooked on shows?
Because you don't want it to go 100, 80, 60, 40.
Exactly. Yeah. They want a constant pattern of people sticking around.
Okay.
And so they release them. So for Breaking Bad, turns out on there, it's episode two. People get hooked very quickly on that.
Yeah.
You look at another wildly successful show, How I Met Your Mother, it's episode eight.
Hmm.
Takes eight episodes for people to stop. Breaking Bad, what's really interesting, that didn't become part of really the zeitgeist until into season four.
Right.
And then it was hugely popular from there. And Netflix was a large part of that.
Yep.
What Netflix is saying, you spend a lot of money creating a pilot. That's the most expensive episode of a show because you've got to do everything for that. And what they found is none of the shows that they looked at were people hooked after the pilot. So by allowing people to watch more episodes at once, they say people become hooked because they will keep watching until they find that episode or they'll drop out. But Netflix is saying we can get people hooked if we just let them have all of them at once.
Now, what's interesting about that is I think that people do get hooked by pilots when they air. Think of the great shows that you have liked. You liked them because you liked the first episode, but you didn't really commit to long-term viewing of that series in that first episode. What you said was, well, I'll watch this next week, or I'll watch the next one of these.
Yes.
And then maybe it's that second one or third one where you then go, all right, I have to watch every episode of this all the way through.
And there are shows where it's every year. Like, it's a cancel or renew in my mind. It's like, okay, not for the TV, but am I canceling it off my DVR? Like, yeah. I have this ranking because I don't have time to watch all the TV. No one does. There's too much out there. But just really interesting to look that they now know when we are, quote unquote, hooked on a show.
Okay, speaking of binge watching, I have a show to recommend. This is not something that's on Netflix, but it's a series that just ended a couple of weeks ago on TNT. And I watched like the first couple of episodes, and then I recorded all the rest of them, and then I binge watched them. It's a show called Murder in the First. It's a police procedural, but it doesn't have everything wrap up in every episode like CSI. They always catch the guy before the end of an hour of CSI, right? Mm-hmm. They wrap up the case, and then the next week it's a new one. Law and Order was another
McCoy
procedural.
McCoy got him every week.
Yeah, whoever it was, that happened. Well, Murder in the First was a story that was told over the course of, I think, maybe 8 or maybe 10 episodes, kind of like a limited series, the kind of thing that is built for binge watching, because you're going to get to the end of it and the story isn't wrapped up and you want to see, well, what happens next? And then what happens next? And then what happens after that?
It's kind of like The Killing, which is also, it centers around one big, that's on Netflix.
Yep. Okay. Well, this one is called Murder in the First. You can watch it free thanks to TNT. If you just download the TNT app, you can watch it on your iPad or your tablet or your computer and access it for free. I think it's 10 hours, which isn't really hours, but it's 10 episodes that were originally an hour when they were broadcast with the commercials. And you can watch it, and I think you might enjoy it if you're into police stories. And this is a very well-told one. It stars Taye Diggs and a woman named Kathleen Robertson. And I like them both a lot, and they're really, really good in this show, Murder in the First. So there's my recommendation for you.
We both like Scientology Going Clear, that the documentary earlier on HBO.
Made by Alex Gibney.
Yes.
The guy who also has one out now about Steve Jobs.
Yes, and we both liked Going Clear. Well, one of the actors who was mentioned in it towards the end when they were talking about leaving the church was Leah Remini. She is now writing a book about her leaving Scientology. She was brought in, and she calls it indoctrinated. I'm not making a value judgment here.
Colin doesn't want to get sued. they're very, very
Miscavige
litigious.
Is everywhere.
Yeah.
She was indoctrinated when she was 10, and her whole family left the church. So she is writing a book. Here's what's interesting about this. You hear about a book, you get anywhere from 3 to 500 days before that book hits shelves. They want you to have time to digest that it's coming out, and they can build up publicity for it.
Yep.
They announced this yesterday. The book comes out November 3rd. That's the power of sort of Scientology there. They're not giving them a lot of time to get their ducks in the row.
Well, what that tells me is that Leah Remini has been writing this book for quite a while, but they held off on announcing it.
Yes. So November 3rd, Troublemaker, Surviving Hollywood and Scientology. And you know her if you're not familiar with
King of Queens.
King of Queens, exactly. Yeah. So definitely from the short excerpts they gave us, sounds like it's worth a read.
Well, you know, Paul Haggis is probably the most famous ex-Scientologist, yes. And he was featured a lot in Going Clear, which, by the way, won the Best Documentary Emmy last weekend at the Emmy Awards. Last hour, I was talking to Phil Rosenthal, who ran the TV show Everybody Loves Raymond. I mentioned a documentary he did a few years ago called Exporting Raymond, which is about how when you have a successful sitcom in America, other countries want to buy that and put that on. And there are three ways they can do that. They can buy it and just run the American version, pay for the rights for that. Or they can buy it and run the American version and dub in whatever the local language is, Spanish, French, Russian, Greek, whatever it is, and run it in that country with the dubbed voices. Or they can buy just the scripts and the idea and make their own version of it. Well, several years ago, somebody in Russia decided that they were going to put on the air their first sitcom. There had never been a sitcom in the history of Russian TV, which, if you think about the Soviet Union, makes sense. But even in the 2.5 decades since the fall of the Soviet Union, Russia has never had a sitcom on the air. They've had, quote, comedy, which was mostly variety shows slapstick with clowns. So they decided that their first show was going to be Everybody Loves Raymond.
Okay.
And they decided, well, let's get the guy who ran that show, have him come over here and help us put this together, because they have to change things for cultural differences that fit more in with Russia than they do in the United States. So Phil Rosenthal agreed to go over there, but he went with a documentary crew. And his adventures trying to adapt, or trying to help them adapt his show. He's already become a multimillionaire because of this show.
Yes.
I mean, huge amounts of money were made by everybody involved in that show. So he agrees to go over there and help them adapt the show for them. And he runs into cultural differences and television frustration problems. And at one point, the woman who's in charge of the costumes for the show declares, well, I'm the only one here who knows what's funny. So I should be the arbiter of what goes on this show and what doesn't, and which actors get hired. And it is a really, really great documentary. It's several years old now, maybe 3 or 4 years old. It's called Exporting Raymond. Get that one. It's streaming now on Netflix, so you can watch it there.
Exporting.
I had Phil on last hour because he's got a show that debuts Monday night on PBS called I'll Have What Phil's Having, which is a documentary show that he did about traveling around the world and eating food.
I wonder if they found someone that talks like Ray Romano.
Well,
he has that voice like that.
I don't want to spoil the documentary for you, but the answer is no.
Oh, okay.
And there's a big battle about who the guy would be, and the guy they pick is about as un-Ray Romano as you could possibly imagine. So, I don't know.
That was my Russian Ray Romano.
It sounded like you were doing your Ray Romano backwards.
Yeah, I know.
So anyway, that's called Exporting Raymond.
Anyway.
Thank you. And two other TV notes here. Actually, a few more TV notes. Brian Regan, one of my favorite stand-up comedians, is going to have a special on Comedy Central tomorrow night. I think it's live from Radio City. It is Comedy Central's first ever live stand-up special.
I think it's live.
No.
That's the promo. That's what he's been saying in the promo. It's Brian Regan, live. Live.
It's their first live stand-up special. Thank you. Thank you, Ray.
That means it's live.
He comes to town and plays the Peabody or the Fox every year or 18 months. And I've just been a fan of his for a long time. So, Brian Regan, set your DVR for that for tomorrow night. Also, I know Ian is going to have his DVR set for two of our favorite shows that are returning tonight. Shark Tank is back on ABC. The Amazing Race is back on CBS. You'll be watching both of those?
Absolutely.
And Monday night, Trevor Noah takes over and debuts his version of The Daily Show.
Yeah, that is Monday. Wow.
You know, of all the people who have had to replace somebody else in late night so far, it was difficult for Larry Wilmore to replace Stephen Colbert, and he is not up to those standards. Stephen Colbert replacing David Letterman wasn't that hard because Letterman was over and had been for a decade, just doing the same show over and over again, and Colbert has made that his own. Jimmy Fallon certainly did a great job taking over for Jay Leno and turning The Tonight Show into something new. But of all of those, I think the hardest task is taking over for Jon Stewart.
Yeah.
And what Trevor Noah does next Monday will be a test. You talk about how long people will stick with the show. If he doesn't nail the landing on Monday night, a lot of people are not going to tune in Tuesday. And I will tell you, his guest Monday night doesn't encourage me. It's that comedian Kevin Hart.
Oh, wow.
I don't find all that amusing. And who's had movie bomb after movie bomb. So that's our showbiz segment for today. Colin will be back in the newsroom in about 20 minutes and then back here with me next Friday for more of this nonsense. This is the Big 550 KTRS.